This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 7th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 270 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the show, we meet the author Jamie Bartlett, who descended into the mysterious world of the web and will be here to tell us what he found.
Then Carla Valentine is the curator responsible for one of the more peculiar museums in the world. She tells us how to make gout, polycystic diseases and other disfigurations the talk of the town.
And later in the programme, we'll look at an adventure tale of a different kind. Geoffrey Pike, inventor, escapee, war correspondent, and a great genius of his time, or so legend has it, is also one of the most unrecognised figures in history. Our guest, Henry Hemming, wrote about his life and work.
All that and, of course, a fine new musical track too, all coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Today's Sunday, Andrew, and quite frankly, I feel like it's time for a Bloody Mary. Normally we'd have one after the show. I think we should maybe try and get one delivered during the show. How do you feel?
Well, I must say that pre-show, you've been talking a lot about having drinks guests on here in future.
Well, you know, I think last year we had, I think maybe they sort of come in towards the end of the year when things are getting a little bit sort of autumnal. It's the season of mists, mellow fruitfulness, and gin.
Yeah, one of our favourites ever guests brought in gin.
That was that one. I can't remember the gin.
It was Christmas.
But it was some very local, small London gin maker came in, and I think we basically drank the entire bottle in the hour. By the end of it, I don't even know who the last guest was.
Well, maybe we should have a segment called The Weekly Gin. And just have a snifter at the end before we kind of depart.
It should be called Gin and Bear It. And it's just like some awful kind of Christmas cracker joke.
Let's do that.
Okay, let's do that. I'm looking forward to by reading the introduction first, I'm looking forward to all the guests. I'm looking forward to the man that will make us say this joke. What is your name? Don't tell him, Pike.
Yes, because we're Dad's Army had a gentleman in it called Pike. And it does say in this book, I was reading it says many people think of the other famous Pike. And I thought they were going to mention him, but they mentioned another Pike that I'd never heard of.
Oh, well, not that famous then.
No. Captain Manwaring.
Captain Manwaring. Before we set the wheels in motion on the show, you know who we've got to welcome into the show? We've got to put a gin and tonic on the end of a bamboo cane and wave it out the door to attract him first. His name is Tom Edwards, and he comes with a news look ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make yourselves at home. It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Oh, I love that round of applause.
It's literally the sound of one hand clapping. Hi, Tom.
I'm used to that. How are you both today?
Really well, thanks, yeah.
Well, we're just pleased to see, because I know you're looking off good to Paris for quite a long time.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, I've made a special effort to pop back and see you this weekend.
You were there at the end of last week. You've come back all for the show, and then you go back again.
Got to be there on Tuesday, Andrew. Got to be there.
And this time you're there for doing radio stuff at Maison et Objet. Mm-hmm.
Which we all know in French is Maison A object.
Well, it's a big exhibition for anybody in the world of design, gifts.
Absolutely.
And you're going to be there. You're our little gift to that world, aren't you?
I am. The ambassador. An ambassador of design.
Come with a ribbon tied to your head.
Possibly. And parsley in my teeth, Andrew.
What's going to happen in the future?
Do you remember we did talk about barrel racing last week? Do you remember that? So I've got a few more.
I thought you were going to name the winner.
Hilarious. No, it's interesting before it's happened. But once
where was
another
that?
Barrel?
What country was that again?
That was in Tuscany somewhere. Yeah. So I thought we'd do some
Kingsley Amis called his fat, short dog the furry barrel, which I think is such a good description.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Such a good description of a fat, hairy dog.
And they'll be on to play. So yeah, Venice Regatta. This is the Regatta Storica, the Grand Canal in Venice. There's all sorts of things happening, though, in Italy today. What about the Joust of the Saracen?
Wow.
That's a jousting tournament in Arezzo. It's taking place in the...
Clue in the name.
Grande Piazza. That's
in Arezzo.
That's the big square.
Okay, good.
So that's what's happening today. It's also World Beard Day today.
Is it?
I don't even know what happens. It just is World Beard Day.
What do they do? Is that sort of to...
Celebration of the beard, Rob.
And they try to sort of highlight...
The plight of beards. The plight of beard, climates. Yeah. I don't know. I
think Have we reached peak beard?
I think we've jumped the shark of beards.
Well, the thing is, you're the beardiest one here.
Am I?
You are looking beardier.
Am I? Mm. I think I need to have a bit of a shave then later on.
Now, Rob, I know you've also been following.
I'll also brush my teeth and have a wee. So that's all coming up.
That's captivating. You've been following sort of British folk and sort of esoterica this summer.
I have. I've gone quite pagan.
No, I can't remember. What about the horn dance? Have you looked into this one?
No, I haven't. So this is taking place.
It's taking place tomorrow in Abbots Bromley. The dancers come out of the Church of St Nicholas wearing antlers, one and all. There's a hobby horse there, Maid Marian, a fool in motley.
Brilliant, I love that.
If there's an opening, I don't know.
Just don't point at me.
And others with musical instruments. They visit houses and farms in the area and then dance in the village streets.
Oh, I love that. Where's that? Where's Abbots?
Abbots Bromley in Staffordshire.
Where's that?
The horn dance.
Staffordshire. I'm sure I can get there. I like anything like that.
You should get along there.
I like all those sorts of things.
And I've got a host of other intriguing things.
Okay, go. Yes.
Sort of literary day on Tuesday. Did you know this? I know you're a fan of the Rolling Stones, of course, Rob. Keith Richards is publishing a children's book.
Oh, yeah, I knew.
That's coming out on Tuesday. Gus and Me, the story of my granddad and my first guitar. Can you imagine?
Amazing.
And Keith's daughter is going to do pen and ink collages to illustrate the books.
It sounds really charming. I think Keith's probably pretty good at that. I think he's a good communicator. But I love the irony of a children's book that can only be bought by the over 18s.
Exactly. And on a slightly more highbrow level, the Man Booker shortlist is revealed the same day on Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, the shortlist. Yeah,
I don't think Keith...
There was quite a hoo-ha about the long list, so I wonder if the shortlist announcement will have as much weight.
Could be controversial. Yeah. And I don't think Keith will be on there.
And this year, the Booker, it's gone international. So it's not. It was always British and Commonwealth, and now they've gone. There were three American authors, one of whom was Joseph O'Neill. And that book, The Dog, I think is absolutely brilliant. I've just finished that. We've reviewed it in the magazine. I hope that he's on the shortlist for sure.
He may make it. So we learn on Tuesday. A couple of other little funny ones. On Friday, Space Whiskey. That's right. Returns to Earth. So they fired whiskey, a consignment of whiskey, into space.
It's just the Scottish space program.
3 years ago. But you can't say that ahead of the independence vote. And it's going to land in Kazakhstan on a rocket, an unmatured malt from the Ardbeg distillery.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's been blasted to the International Space Station, along with particles of charred oak. Scientists hope to... They hope to understand how the particles of charred oak and the unmatured malt will interact at close to zero gravity. For what ends? They're not clear.
Marketing.
Who knows?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, would you drink it when it came back from space?
It's been orbiting for over 1,000 days. I think it deserves to be drunk.
Yeah, it does. I'll happily... I mean, you've got to go to Kazakhstan.
Well, no, then they're going to take it to Texas.
Right.
To compare... that with a control sample, if there's any left.
Okay.
They sort of shot some Jim Beam up, did they, as well?
Extraordinary stuff.
He was driving the plane.
Absolutely. And one final thing, this is quite good, a sporting one, just to close. Next Saturday, the Formula E racing begins. This is the fully electric, single-seater racing cars, like Formula One, but they're all electronic. Imagine the sound. Imagine the sights and sounds of that.
You won't hear them. They'll just be
probably
going
quite,
around,
really unsafe.
Quite dangerous.
They're probably just going around quietly.
It's quite easy to get run over by a Toyota Prius, isn't it?
But it's very exciting. There's all sorts of exciting people involved in this, big companies, and it'll all wrap up in the summer of next year.
Are they allowed to have e-cigarette advertising on them, do you think?
Oh, I don't know.
That's a fair point. Where is the race?
So this first one takes place in Beijing, and the series wraps up in London next summer. So I'm genuinely excited about that. I think it's really interesting and exciting.
I think it's eminently sponsorable. I think it could be really big business, actually, that thing. I think it's quite good. Who is it? And what about drivers and things? I wonder if anyone sort of famous
drivers. I'm not sure, but
they've got
all the hangers on. So Leonardo DiCaprio, he's backing a team. Richard Branson, predictably, he's in on it. I think there'll be a Virgin car as well. So big names certainly in the stands, if not at the wheels.
Tom, I love that. Now you may get back on the Eurostar and go back to France for your holiday. Well, I mean, your Maison Objet.
Exactly. It's hard graft, don't forget. I'll see you there, Andrew.
Yeah, you did get that restaurant list, didn't you?
Well, you know, one has to try when one's visiting these sorts of places.
Maison et vacances. Thanks, Tom. Beyond the everyday world of Gmail, Facebook and Twitter lies a much deeper, darker world of communities and cultures where people can be anyone or anything they want, a world that is fascinating as it is disturbing.
These dark corners are a separate realm, one that is very little analysed or understood. Jamie Bartlett, author of a new book called The Dark Net, Inside the Digital Underworld, ventured into the deep dark world of the internet and is here to tell us what he found. Now, we talk about the dark net, and it's, you know, a term that pops up in newspapers increasingly. Before we kind of venture into it, explain exactly what it is and how it exists.
Well, for me, the dark net was really just this sort of big cluster of very dark, mysterious, little understood subcultures where the darker side of human nature is on display. So that doesn't necessarily need to be in a hidden, secretive part of the internet. It can be in a Facebook group. It really can be anywhere on the internet. And for me, it was dark because it wasn't understood. Now, part of that, and I do write about it in the book, is what some people do term the dark net, sort of capital letters, meaning an encrypted part of the internet that you can't access with a commercial browser or a commercial search engine, and you need a special anonymous browser to find it, and where really your anonymity is guaranteed, and there are websites there that can't really be shut down and people can browse it without being traced.
And the reason that this comes up in our newspapers is for two reasons, I guess. You know, paedophilia, that people are looking for sexual images or disturbing images, especially to do with children, and crime. So we're always being told that, you know, that there's a world of drug dealing and gun selling and all sorts of things that goes. And is that a kind of a bad characterization of what goes on there, or is that the majority of what goes on there?
It's certainly a large part of what goes on there. There are sort of uncensored, uncontrollable drugs markets down there selling everything. There is child abuse images there too. But of course, lots of people have very good reasons to try to maintain their anonymity. So it's also the place where, for example, the WikiLeaks cache is held. It's also the place where dissident democratic groups, worried about the prying eyes of their autocratic or dictatorial regimes, are watching them, and they find cover there. The New Yorker magazine, one of the great, most esteemed magazines of the world, has a Dropbox site there too to allow whistleblowers to share information. So the great and the good live side by side, looking for that anonymity and secrecy.
Just before I pass it on to the last question on this, what stops it being traceable then? Why is it that, you know, the New Yorker can have a Dropbox there, that we know what hackers can do, we know what governments can do? What makes it untraceable?
Well, when you browse the web, you have an IP address that's connected to your device or your home or your internet connection. And what this system does is essentially to mask that. It's quite a clever little system, rather technical to describe, but essentially it has a traffic encryption system whereby lots of computers join a network and they all agree to bounce your request for data from a website through a number of these networks, these nodes, they call them, so that when the request comes out at the other end, it's essentially been anonymized. You can't trace it back to who it is that's browsing these sites. Now, the websites are also hard to find because they use the same system, but they're hosted on servers that, again, are located all over the world that are very hard to pin down. So the upshot of it is, you know that people are browsing, you just don't know where they're coming from.
Has this always existed, the under-the-water bit of this sort of landscape painting that is the internet?
Well, in terms of sort of, have there always been sort of slightly strange, often quite shocking subcultures that are part of the internet ecology? Yes, from the very beginning, of course there has been. The idea of a sort of second hidden parallel internet, that's rather more recent. But it was only about a decade or so ago that work started on this, funded by the US Navy, as indeed the internet was originally a US military project, to help people working for the US military to share information anonymously and to browse the web anonymously. Then it was taken over by sort of civil liberties groups who thought it was a fantastic tool.
I was going to ask you about the sort of the lighter side of the dark side, if you know what I mean. We're talking about dissident groups or freedom fighters, online freedom fighters. It's not necessarily all gun running and child
porn. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. Of course, if you look around at what's going on in the world, and there are many good reasons why many people need to shield their identity online. I mean, this book really is just to explore specifically some of the darker parts of internet culture rather than just that bit of the net. Of course, a lot of it takes place there. The reality is, though, even in these sort of slightly more shocking and darker internet subcultures, there's often a lighter side there too. There's often a side when you actually look at it a bit more closely. It's not really as shocking or surprising as you might imagine.
Do we behave on the internet like we behave in real life? I mean, can you trace, this is a bit like the simple act of looking at one's internet history is an interesting window onto what people do, but it's not necessarily what they would do in real life, as there is an anonymity to sitting behind a laptop screen itself, let alone the underneath of the internet that you're talking about, right? I wonder whether the internet is shaped like human behaviour.
Yes, of course. I mean, all the tools that we use to communicate with each other in some ways shape our behaviour. And the internet is particularly a faceless type of communication. You don't need to look at the people. You don't even need to speak directly to the people you're communicating with. The fact as well that online everything is so easy to find, everything is but a click away, means, frankly, it's easier to do bad things. It's easier to find bad things. So it allows you to sort of sate every curiosity. Now, some people will use that in fantastically wonderful ways, and other people are sort of sucked into, I suppose, exploring their own darker sides. I don't think it's making us nastier or meaner, but I think it's giving license to us to express that far more easily than it was before.
By the very nature of the topic, it's not the kind of thing that people often want to talk about, running one of these sites or being involved in this kind of world. Was it very difficult to get people to begin to open up to you about, you know, you're talking here about sites where you can, you know, order a killing. You're talking about people dealing drugs. How difficult was it to get an in, to get people to start telling you their tales?
Well, what I was trying to do was to paint a slightly more nuanced picture of some of these cultures, just to understand the people behind it and to realise on careful inspection that there's much more to it than it first appears. Now, when you actually go into these places and try and communicate with the people that are part of it, they're actually surprisingly open, because I think most people who live on the fringes feel that their worlds are misunderstood.
Do they also have a very good understanding of the legality of their anonymity?
Yeah, depends on who you're speaking
to. But I wonder if you know that.
Yes, and of course it took a lot of sort of persuading people, a lot of time spent with them before they would agree to talk openly about what they do and why. But on the whole, and I found this in other things that I've worked on, people who live on the fringes do feel like they maybe sometimes have an axe to grind, or they want themselves to be portrayed more fairly, more honestly, more objectively, because frankly, there is a lot of scare stories out there about neo-Nazis on the net, about internet trolls, about these drug sites. And I think I was going in there to try and look at them objectively and more fairly, and I certainly found stuff that I wasn't expecting. And so actually, people are willing to talk. And I think that's actually fairly refreshing in many ways.
One of the sites you look at is Silk Road, which has had, again, quite a lot of publicity. It's a place where you can go and buy drugs. I think your opening line is buying drugs on Silk Road is a lot of fun. But tell us about how does this run as, like, effectively, you know, a business, a corporation that's tucked away, ungettable at?
It's ungettable at in the sense that it uses that same sort of encryption system that I was talking about earlier. It's close to impossible to shut down, and thousands of people use it. It's very professional. It's like eBay or Amazon. And when I say like eBay or Amazon, what I mean is you are confronted with an almost impossible amount of choice. You arrive at this drugs website and you have 10,000 different things to choose from, every drug imaginable, things that I've never heard of. Now, what that does is essentially introduces choice and competition into an area that has been traditionally dominated by cartels, by small groups of people. Now, what that does for the consumer is that it gives them greater choice. They can leave vendors they're not happy with. They can, you know, change their dealers very, very simply and easily. So the vendors suddenly have an incentive to think about whether the customer's happy. And the site works, not because of encryption or Bitcoin.
Are there things like feedback, like you have on Amazon
eBay? It works principally because they have a feedback mechanism system. So everyone gives their dealer a score out of 5, and they give their product a score out of 5. And when you go to the site to decide which drug to buy, what do? You look at their feedback. Now, what that means is the vendors are desperate to get good feedback from the people that are buying it. So they will bend over backwards to give you a great service, money back if you're not happy, free package and delivery. And as a result, actually, the purity of the drugs is higher than on the streets. And more importantly, it's more predictable, which, of course, when you're ingesting drugs, you need to know the purity of drugs. I mean, this is one of the reasons people tragically die as a result of overdosing. Price is pushed down because these vendors are competing with each other. And on the whole, as a consumer, it's an extremely pleasant, easy, enjoyable experience. Morally ambiguous, because there are plus sides here. We could strip away some of the street crime associated with drugs. You can be more confident that you're not going to overdose because your heroin has been laced with anthrax. But at the same time, it's making drugs far easier to get to far more people, which has, of course, downsides. And actually, it's quite a good microcosm of the whole book, because all of these cultures, when you look at them closely, it's shades of grey. It's not very obviously really bad or really good, but there's always a subplot in there.
We should do a Silk Road advert. Let me just get them to sponsor a show.
We haven't got much time left, but just a couple of quick things. You obviously work for a think. Well, not obviously, you work for a think tank called Demos, which is obviously looking at, you know, policy around some often quite contentious issues. When you did this book, just tell us quickly, did you have that frame of mind when you're thinking, actually, the law needs to catch up with this world?
I went into this book trying to avoid that bit of my job. I wanted it to be a series of portraits, because just of stories about these different cultures, rather than being polemic or rather than thinking what is to be done, because I feel like what is to be done depends on all of us, society, what we think about these issues and these communities and these cultures. And I didn't think we'd even got to the point where anyone knew anything much about them. So I felt like my job here was simply to present them, simply to present the world here as I saw it, and let everybody make their own mind up about what they think should be done. But clearly, some of these communities and cultures are some way ahead of government in terms of how they use the technology, how smart they are, how they avoid detection. What's to be done about that? I'm really not sure.
The thing is when that dark web becomes human behaviour that is not just online, it is human behaviour that is acted out in real life, as it were. I suppose that's when government legality and law enforcement kind of comes into it in an offline way, when that behaviour becomes street crime.
Yeah, perhaps, although
or becomes abuse of people, whether they're children or whether it's gun, you know, where do the guns that are bought on Silk Road end up? I guess that's the side that.
That's right.
It's even darker than the dark web, isn't it?
Well, yes, of course. And human behaviour offline, I think, is far worse than the things we ever get
up to
online.
It's an interesting thing that you can learn so much and become sort of embroiled in this online world, but acting as you would online offline is perhaps when it becomes, in its manifestation, it becomes the most dangerous thing.
Well, that's right. It's very easy to get sort of sucked into online subcultures and not really realise what they're doing to you or what they're doing to others around you. And then that behaviour translates into the rest of your life. But the reality is that for most people these days, there's not such a fine distinction. And that includes for governments. You've all seen over the last 4 or 5 years increasing efforts to regulate bits of the internet, various reasons. And that's because people can do very bad things online. It doesn't have to be an offline thing. You know, accessing child pornography doesn't require you to leave your room. And that's an extremely serious crime. So there's plenty that you can do online that's bad. But the story, as ever, is there's plenty you can do that's good as well. And I'm just focusing on the bad stuff for now. But there's plenty of other. Maybe the next one will be a book about the light.
The dark web is shades of grey, I suppose.
It is shades of grey. Yeah. So that's exactly the message I'd like to get out.
Well, Jamie Bartlett, author of The Dark Web, thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to play you some new music now, Andrew. I normally ask you the question, but today I'm not going to ask you because you always just say yes. Maybe one day I'll say, do you fancy some new music, Andrew? And you go, absolutely not, Rob. I hate all the tracks you play.
No, I don't want any.
We're going to have something new. This is called No Other Way. It's new from Sinead Harnett, who's one of those South London dance hall types. It's very nice. Check it out. If you let go, really. That was No Other Way, new from Sinead Harnett.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
In August, one of London's best-kept secrets and one of its most unusual museums opened its doors to the public for the first time. The beautiful Grade 2 listed Barts Pathology Museum at St Bartholomew's Hospital houses over 5,000 medical specimens and pathological pots.
Pathological pots? I like one of those, Rob. Anyway, among them are such horrors as a gout-inflated hand, the bound foot of a Chinese woman, and polycystic ovaries. Well, we're now joined in the studio by Clara Valentine, who's going to tell us all about this exhibition, or the permanent exhibition, and exactly what you're up to. So first of all...
Doesn't she look so well? Presumably they're not...
Yeah, I don't know what you expected.
They're not cold from the current guest.
This is one of those rare moments where you wish there was a webcam, because you don't look like somebody who spends all their day with, horrors like a gout-inflated hand. Anyway... Tell us exactly about this collection then. So I understand it was started long way back in the 1800s, and it was there for medical students rather than as a kind of house of horrors.
That's right. Most medical museums in the UK are from Victorian era. They were sort of built as part of the anatomical and dissection schedules and, you know, curriculums of the universities. At the moment, there aren't really many that are open to the public at all. The only one that is the Royal College of Surgeons in Lincoln's Inn Fields, but that's not part of a university. So our museum is very different in that it is a university museum. It is in use by the medical students, but it's also in use for various different bits and pieces, such as filming for documentaries or evening events.
And you've slightly kind of opened the creaky door to allow the public in, certainly over since the summer, and then occasionally in the evenings as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The reason we decided to do our daytime openings during August are for the obvious reason that we don't have any students there. So it made sense to sort of, as you say, fling the creaky doors open and allow people to pop in and out. We will hopefully do that again next year. Maybe we'll be able to do it during another holiday, such as Easter. But what we do is evening events.
Cheer up the kids. Don't give them a little bunny. Let them come and see a nice chopped off hand.
A cirrhotic liver.
The children actually really love it. You know, they probably love it more than the adults. But then that's the kind of child I was. So, you know.
And is that the thing? I mean, there's an idea. Having looked online at some of the exhibits there, I didn't use the word grisly in the introduction, even though it's in the script, because it was one of those things, because I wonder whether it is, are the exhibits grisly or are they warnings from history? What exactly are the things? We can talk through them because we talked about some of the things, yeah. I guess, in jars in the introduction. Mm. But they're a bit of a kind of like warning shot across the bows. You can see why adults like it less than the kids, right?
Yeah, definitely, because of course adults with their glasses of wine don't want to see hands that have been inflated by gout and that sort of thing. But what's actually really interesting is that because it's a Victorian medical museum and it's full of these Victorian conditions that you may never have thought were going to resurge again, like tuberculosis and syphilis, a lot of those things are actually coming back again. So it's good for children to learn about them.
And tell me, the collection, is it still added to, or are students working off a group of items and parts of bodies that were collected, 100 years ago?
We don't have any new specimens coming into our collection, which is probably a good job because I'm the only one who works there and we've got 5,000 of them, which I am sort of gradually getting through and repairing and cataloguing. So the students still do dissections over at Mile End as part of Queen Mary University of London, but it's a very different system. It's donated cadavers and then there's a burial sort of every year.
But they still pop over to see the Victorian ones?
They come over to see the Victorian ones because, for the most part, they're going to display conditions that, as I say, we don't really see as much anymore. And they're a lot of things very rare, you know, kidneys that are sort of half a metre large. And, you know, it's difficult on the radio to explain why that's so large, but a kidney should be the size of your fist. So
what's wrong with the kidney if it would be that big?
It's polycystic. It's got many, many cysts on it. Right. So it's gradually gotten bigger and bigger. So, and those kinds of things you can only see in context compared to a lot of other kidneys. So that's why it's really valuable.
Rob's going to be a bit of a hypochondriac. I can see it all afternoon now.
It's literally, no. I've heard
of that. What's that pain? Is that my metre-long kidney?
I think you'd probably know about it if it was a metre big, but, you know, it just certainly keeps me going to the gym sort of 4 or 5 times a week.
Sure it does. Yeah. And what are the things? I mean, there's things in here which, as we said, we've talked about the sort of polycystic kidneys. We've talked about cirrhotic livers and all these sort of things, which are, you know, and gout and things. These are all sort of things that, at least in Edwardian England, were associated with kind of overindulgence.
Yeah.
There's lots of things in here, like the bound Chinese lady's foot. There's a sort of cultural artefact as much. There's a sort of anthropomorphic element to this, which is sort of fascinating. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the Chinese foot is very interesting because we've got 2 feet. One of them is covered in soft tissue, so you can still see the toes and the toenails, and one is skeletal, so you can actually see the deformity of the bones. And, you know, that's something I think it's useful to see, because we do consider nowadays, you know, women with our high heels, and we feel like, oh, it's torture to wear these. It's like having bound feet, and it's really not. And it's only when you see this specimen, you know, that you see the difference in what was achieved and what they were put through. And we have a similar specimen, which is a tight lacer's liver. So she wore a corset 24 hours a day, very tightly laced. And it shows the deformities caused by that. And
stops it from being a metre long, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Tell me, what was the actual liquid there stored in then?
Nowadays, the liquid's called Kaiserling 3. It sounds very sort of fancy. It has got some formaldehyde in it, but it's mainly glycerin, sodium acetate.
And do you have to kind of top the jars up quite regularly? So you're unscrewing the lids and kind of fishing out the bound foot and putting in some fresh water?
Sort of. With the Victorian specimens in the nice glass pots, which they're much more aesthetically pleasing as well, it's a 3 or 4 day process to actually top them up and regenerate them, but they should stay like that for 20 to 25 years. So it sort of is worth the effort. With the perspex pots, what they tend to do is they actually have microscopic holes which breathe. So they need to be topped up once a year or so. So that can be, it's a bit like painting the fourth bridge. You know, I sort of get to one end of the floor and I have to go back to the other end.
So the Victorians did it better.
They did, yeah. And I don't really know. It's one of those things that the 70s was responsible for. You know, let's pot everything in plastic and it's really a bad idea. So actually what I'm doing is trying to put most of it back into glass again.
The Tupperware generation, Rob. They've got lots to be blamed for.
Also, Kaiserling 3 sounds like a middling but quite nice wine from the outside.
It does actually, doesn't it? Yeah.
Do you have a favourite item in there?
I have got several favourite items, really. I've got a new one at the moment. It's called the Asheim-Zondek test, and it's an old-style pregnancy test. And it's from when, in the old days, sort of around 1920s, 30s, ladies who thought they were pregnant would have their urine injected into mice. And then the mice would be killed a couple of days later and their ovaries would be looked at. And if they had certain growths in their ovaries, they knew the woman was pregnant. So it's quite an interesting one.
So the test worked?
It did work, yeah. And then it became the rabbit test, which is a euphemism for pregnancy. People say, oh, the rabbit died. That means someone's pregnant. Yeah, so it
sounds like something that happens at a particular type of Berlin nightclub.
or going to boots in those days must have been quite exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Lots of squeaking in the pharmacy section. And we've managed to get through this whole conversation without asking you what you actually do as curator. Mm. Because that's, I mean, I guess these things are all extant. It's not being added to as a collection. Mm. So what's your role?
Initially, I was taken on to repair all of the pots, to organise them, catalogue them, and to photograph them for the sort of virtual website. As I've been there, the role has expanded quite a bit. So I've been doing research for our new public website. I organise all the events. They're basically just things that I think this would be quite interesting to have. So yeah. I'll get in touch with lecturers and
there's lots
and
of things like the Sherlock Holmes Society meets there.
Exactly.
I think something was shot in the BBC series was shot there.
Yeah.
That's all part and parcel of it.
Yeah.
And the reason for that being that was where Conan Doyle set their first meeting.
It's funny actually that you say that, because I had some tourists knock on my office today to say, is this the room that Conan Doyle wrote? It's a study in Scarlet that he wrote there. So, and it was, that is my office now. It's really where I store my gin. But we do get a lot of gym.
Your Kaiserling, hunky your Kaiserling 3.
Yeah, it's all
comes in a Hendrix bottle. It's really weird. I like it. It's a fascinating place. And is it a place where you, I don't know what hours you keep there as the curator? Is it the kind of place where you don't necessarily want to be the last one out at night?
To be honest, I work pretty much alone all day anyway, so it doesn't bother me. I tend to get in about 8 and work pretty late. I have actually locked somebody in there by accident once, a poor young man who came to fix my radiators. He wasn't very happy.
And does anything ever go wrong with this? You know, formaldehyde isn't always the most stable, I presume, of materials, especially ages. Do you get the odd exploding ovary?
I haven't had that, thankfully. I think with formaldehyde, if something goes wrong, you would know about it to look at me.
You need to, basically, what you're saying is you need to reinsure your shark.
Well, thank you very much. That's an amazing introduction and to the world of St. Bartholomew's Hospital and the Pathology Museum. Thank you very much for coming
in
to see us.
Thanks.
That was Carla Valentine, technical curator at Bart's Pathology Museum right here in London.
Up next, we head back to the Belle Epoque for adventures, inventors and spies.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and 2 in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Now, some say he was a genius of his time, but many of us will never have heard of him. Geoffrey Pike was an inventor, a war correspondent, and a fugitive who lived through both world wars, and even convinced Churchill you could build an aircraft carrier out of reinforced ice.
And it seems that Pike was an even more complex figure. In 2009, MI5 released a mass of material suggesting that he was in fact a senior official in the Soviet Comintern. Henry Hemmings has now, more than 6 decades after Pike's death, written the true story of Geoffrey Pike. It's called Churchill's Iceman, in fact, the book. And he joins us on the weekly now. Henry, welcome to the show. I was going to call
you.
It a programme, a showgram.
Why not? That's compelling.
And in terms of, okay, let's go with that theme, a showgram, which is halfway between a show, a piece of sort of like a piece of entertainment, and a programme, which is a piece of factual entertainment.
Yes, you've much like
your,
my book.
You've written your book in the style of a sort of, it's got quite an adventure story vibe
to
it.
Yeah, that's something that came up in one of the most recent reviews, and I love that. I've tried very, very hard to make it gripping. I mean, I suppose every author does, but I've really studied thriller structure and tried to make sure that at every point I know why the reader is still reading.
Always
questions.
He's looking over
drawing
your shoulder.
Them on. Exactly.
And I mean, obviously, and Geoffrey Pike was there at some of the key moments through the First and the Second World War, obviously key to that. How come we don't necessarily know very much about him?
Because of the nature of the man.
Right.
He was someone who was obsessed with coming up with new ideas. I mean, I sometimes like to think of him as if he was a character from a comic book armed with this special power, which in his case was this remarkable capacity for innovation. So spotting problems before other people and identifying radical solutions. But he was not quite so turned on by implementing those ideas. So what really got him, the story of his life, is coming up with stunningly original, radical ideas. And by its nature, I mean, the history of innovation is dominated by the people who implement these ideas. Nobody today learns about Paolo Toscanelli. They learn about Christopher Columbus. Mm-hmm. Paolo Toscanelli was the man who came up with the idea of reaching the East Indies via the Atlantic.
Paolo Toscanelli just booked his flights.
Poor guy. If only he'd known.
And tell me, how did you know about Geoffrey Pike? What turned up his story in your world?
I wrote about him in a previous book called In Search of the English Eccentric. And he pops up in anthologies of English eccentrics because of this aircraft carrier made out of ice. So I was intrigued by him. I read the one book that he'd written back in 1916, a brilliant account of his journey into Germany and then out again. And I then read the one biography of him written back in the 1950s. And towards the end of that, there was the most fascinating line, I mean, real catnip for any biographer, in which the person who'd written this book said, I want to thank the family and everyone else for helping me out, but I'm so sad I wasn't able to get to the quarter ton of personal papers that Pike left behind. And so I made it my business to find these papers no matter what. I found these papers, I finally got access, and it took a while to persuade the family. And then, just a month later, MI5 released all of their material on Jeffrey Pike, which, I mean, I must have had a really bad time in a former life, because this is just the most extraordinary stroke of luck. And so the combination of being able to read the MI5 papers with Pike's personal diaries, letters, notebooks, and so on, which nobody had ever done before, was the basis of this book. So that's how it came about.
The reluctance of the family to release that quarter ton of papers, was that because of this, you know, element that Rob alluded to, that, you know, there was some suggestion that he was working for the Soviets?
No, it was purely down to impulsiveness on my part, in the sense that I called up the family the moment I had the number, and I wasn't entirely sure what to say. I was grilled over the phone by the daughter-in-law of Jeffrey Pike, Janet Pike, and she decided that I hadn't read all the books that she wanted me to have read. So essentially said, look, I don't think you're quite right to do this. Come back when you've read some more and you know exactly what you're talking about. So that's where the reluctance came from. And then I did my research. I got more into it. I asked, what would Jeffrey Pike do in this situation? And ended up writing this incredibly long letter to Janet Pike explaining why this book should happen, why it was necessary, and why I should do it. Eventually, she said yes.
And we've talked about Pike the inventor, and we should talk about a couple of the things that he put into plan. That he put into plan or put into implementation after he'd come up with the original brainwave, yes, and then didn't follow through with it. So give us a couple of examples for our listeners who will be intrigued, certainly, in the thing we talked about in the introduction, in the aircraft carrier made of ice.
Absolutely. Well, it's everything from the US Special Forces through to a revolutionary kindergarten inspired by Freud. He invented a new kind of motorcycle sidecar. He also came up with an aircraft carrier made out of ice. He's the founder of the mass observation movement. And he also came up with a radical plan to avert the outbreak of the Second World War, which is one of my personal favorites.
Well, how on earth did he feel that this was going to happen? By writing a very long letter to someone.
Yeah, it never fails. He realized that there was one thing that he could do as an ordinary citizen, and that was to carry out an undercover Gallup poll of German public opinion. And of course, at the time, this was deemed to be impossible. MI6, the British Foreign Intelligence Agency, did not have a single British agent in Germany. It was thought that the Gestapo would pounce upon anyone who arrived in the country trying to do something like this. But Pike had the idea of sending in a team of English German school teachers, so English men and women who happened to teach German, and telling them to behave as completely over-the-top, eccentric tourists, knowing that most people in Germany have a soft spot for the eccentric English tourist and would happily open their hearts to this this bumbling group of people who are going to meander through the country. And in August 1939, this is precisely what happened. He got a team of 12 undercover Gallup pollsters into Germany. They roamed all over the country. They collected a huge amount of data. Everything was going well until the agreement between Germany and the Soviet Union. And then everything changed and they had to get back. History intervened, in other words.
Yes, that was strange sort of year and a half long axis that happened between Germany and the Soviet Union, right?
Exactly, yeah. which changed public opinion in Germany at a stroke. So suddenly there was, having been a marked ambivalence towards the idea of going to war. Indeed, people who talked to these pollsters saying, we'd love Hitler to go to war so that he could then lose and then the Nazis would be ousted, to this extraordinary galvanizing which followed that treaty.
Now, the book records obviously a sad thing, which is in 1948, he takes his own life. What led him to that decision?
That's one of the mysteries, I think, about his life. There are various theories. One of the people who wrote about him thought it was the intellectual frustration of trying to help set up the NHS, which is what he was doing at that time. He was working on a report into how the NHS would be 20, 30, 40 years down the line. But I think it has more to do with an undiagnosed disease that he was suffering from, namely Addison's. And this played, I think, a significant part in his his state of mind, but also his physical state. He was in great mental and physical pain by the time he took his own life. And the one other thing to say is I've uncovered a diary entry from 6 months before he killed himself, in which he talks about the D problem, which is almost certainly death or indeed depression. And he doesn't describe exactly what his solution is to this problem, but he does say that having made the decision, I feel a lot better. And I think there's a good chance that he tackled this in the way that he tackled so many other problems and came up with.
And your book is set out as a series of solving problems as well. The chapter headings are all about him solving all these complicated things that he came up across in his life.
Exactly. So everything from how to escape from a concentration camp in the First World War through to how to educate your child.
And yeah, because he set up a progressive school, didn't he, for his son, because he didn't want his son to be bullied in the same way that he was.
Exactly.
He was the only Jewish boy at his boarding school or whatever and was bullied to hell, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was this bizarre decision by his mum.
Yeah.
His mum, who was worried that she was raising a child who was not sufficiently religious and also raising a child who was ill-disciplined. I mean, this is a common concern for all sorts of people all over the world. Her answer...
It was B-Dales. No, I'm
joking. Pretty much. Wellington.
Yeah, kind of the opposite. And I wanted to ask you, when people get into the thick of studying a character from history, whoever that character is, there is a romance often between the historian and the character.
There is.
And did you fall for Geoffrey Pike,
or
do you hate and love him in equal measure? What's your relationship with him?
I definitely fell for him. Mm. It followed the course of a classic relationship. We were madly in love, and then after about two to three years, everything cooled off a little bit, and I began to have my doubts. But then I fell back in love, but it was a different kind of appreciation. And I mean, thank God, by the time I'd finished doing all the research, I was not still in love in the sense that I had distance. And I think if you don't have distance, you shouldn't write a biography.
And just tell me, looking at the book, what's interesting is, you know, obviously his personal story is very fascinating, but it's also fascinating because it's an echo of many of the things other people faced at that time. You know, the issue about, you know, what you felt about communism and socialism and all these issues, especially if you were an intellectual. But do you think that there were more people around like him at the time? When we read this today, somebody who is so good at doing so many different things seems extraordinary. But I wonder if actually back in the 40s, people did have a broader range of interests and ambitions and thoughts if they were an intellectual. They weren't kind of pigeonholed into, you know, just doing one tiny thing.
I think it was almost harder then to get a new idea across than it is today. And I think he was rare. And he really struggled. And in many ways, the story of his life is coming up against this brick wall of an almost Victorian reluctance to accept innovation. I think innovation has less of a bad name today than it did back then. He was unique. I don't think he was of a type. And I suppose the one thing that he demonstrated, which you could not do today, was how far you can get without qualifications. He was uniquely or remarkably unqualified. He didn't even have a university degree, and yet he was taken seriously by Churchill, by Mountbatten, by senior scientists of the time. It was his intellect which allowed him to get where he did.
It was a fascinating story. It's called the book is called Churchill's Iceman. The author is Henry Hemmings. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you.
And there we have it, 270 down, Andrew, of those programmes. Referring back to our dark web guest, what do you think? Are you going to go back to a reporter's notebook and a biro behind your ear and never touch a computer yet, ever again?
It's fascinating that there is this kind of other world that exists on the web. But when it seems I'm mainly kind of Googling kind of nice sofa and kind of vase, I wish I had your job. I'm doing up my house. But it makes me think
I'm
not too scared. I'm not heading over the wall.
You're not going to the Silk Road?
No.
I mean, I'm sure there's some really nice vases. It's just what comes in them. I opened the vase, it was full of this powder.
I think there's a restaurant near us called the Silk Road. Maybe that's where it pops out.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you have to go in the tradesman's entrance.
But no, it's...
Sounds yeah, rude than it is.
But the very nature of doing journalism about something that people don't want written about.
Yeah.
And it's a good on him for kind of sticking his nose in.
also our man writing about Geoffrey Pike, he was great. I love this sort of forgotten, almost a folk hero of both wars, but especially the Second World War, the man that decided the best way to sort of win the North Atlantic War would be to make an aircraft carrier of ice. These kind of things, we need more of these things, not just in science fiction, don't we?
Yeah, and there's a very nice moment in the book where Mountbatten goes to see Churchill and Churchill's in his bath. And he takes a little kind of piece of this material and he plonks it in Churchill's bath and he thinks the water's going to go cold. And then he's all excited by the very nature of this ice that just doesn't melt and kind of sits in the water.
How does he know?
Well, hold on. Anyway, we can bring us back to our gin and tonic. Permanent gin and tonics, the ice won't melt.
No, I like that. That's what we need. That'd be the perfect one, wouldn't it? I think as the days draw in, the best gin and tonic to have is one with a little bit of rosemary in.
This is a recipe
I think pioneered by my fiancée, actually. She puts a sprig of rosemary in it, ideal for the autumn. Or for the summer. I'm not complaining. Should we say our goodbyes?
Yes, do it.
We've got to thank everybody for coming on the show, all our guests. We've got to thank the ladies behind the glass. Claire Urban was our studio manager.
And Isabel Kayser.
And Isabel Kayser was the producer of the programme. And we'll be back the same time, same place next week. I think we probably will, won't we? We're kind of doing a lot of travelling around, a lot of book signings, Andrew. Let's not euphemise that. We're actually going to be signing books.
But so we're in Berlin on Monday. We're going to be in Paris on Tuesday, Antwerp on Wednesday. So if you're a subscriber, I hope we're going to see you then. But we'll be back here in time for the Monocle Weekly next Sunday.
Kaboom. So all that remains for us to do is to thank everybody else for tuning in. Thank you.